This is episode 95, Everybody Wants to Be a Formula One Driver. Coming up on today's special episode, we talk to Joe Saywood about testing, travel and teamwork. On the line, we have Mr. Joe Saywood, a name many of you already know and a man we've mentioned on the show many times. Joe writes and produces the e-magazine Grand Prix Plus and authored the book Grand Prix Saboteurs. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I was a mister. It's very exciting being a mister.
How are you doing today?
That's good, yes. I'm having a nice quiet Sunday, which is one of the last quiet Sundays for a while.
Absolutely. So. Everything kicks off in Australia. Are you looking forward to it?
Sort of, yes. I think the first part of the season is designed to kill people. You know, you've got four races in 5 weekends, and if you actually sit there and work out the mileage, it's at least 50,000 flying miles in a month. So it's fairly busy, but that's quite useful because, you know, you can put the miles in and get upgrades and things later on. So we also catch up on the movies. That's the other great thing. If you travel on the right airlines, you can see all the latest movies. So.
And in the off-season, you fall behind.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm way behind on the latest movie releases because I don't generally go to the cinema much. So.
And when does it all kick off for you then? When do you get going for Australia? Are you packing now?
No, not yet. Generally, because it's such an intensive start to the season, I'm going at the very last minute possible to Australia because, you know, one has family commitments and things, and a month away, effectively, what it boils down to means that I'm holding on as long as I can. So I'll be leaving on, I think it's the Monday, which gets you into Australia on the Wednesday because of the time differences and things. So I'll be there from Wednesday morning, which is plenty of time if you don't mind a bit of jet lag.
Goodness me, a lot of jet lag.
Well, jet lag is part of life. You know, it's not something you can live with it. If you suffer from it really badly, you'll just go bonkers in the end, and you won't be able to sleep ever. So we just sort of lead strange half-lives where we go to sleep when we need to.
And you say you're going late this year, and Monday does seem quite late. What in the past would you have gone earlier when you had less family commitments?
Well, not really, no. I mean, I've had family commitments for, he's wandering around somewhere, 16 years.
Blimey.
So, you know, one gets used to it. But it certainly, when I was, you know, starting out, I wrote a blog item the other day actually about it. You know, when I was in my 20s, I was going away for 10 weeks at a time and just going from place to place. But that was a different world then. We didn't have the internet. And I had, you know, you had one deadline a week, which was nowadays, you just think, wow, isn't that great? I was completely spoiled. because nowadays you don't have such thing as a deadline because it was yesterday. You know, everything is now, now, now.
And the people who you're going to meet in the paddock, the people essentially you're going to spend the next, 9 months with, presumably you haven't had much contact with them during the off-season, so there's going to be a lot of catching up to do when you arrive on Wednesday.
Well, not really, because, I mean, you keep in contact with people. There are events. I don't go to a great deal in the winter because living in France, it just, you know, it creates a huge amount of extra cost, which is really not necessary for what you're getting. So I don't do tests. I go to occasional functions if I think they're worth it and if they fit in with other things I'm doing. So I was in London last week, I think it was. I went to the Science Museum to see an exhibition about the technology of Formula One, which was fascinating. I have to say, it's an extraordinarily good thing, and it's a wonderful exhibition to show what Formula One is actually contributing to the world in addition to pollution and lots of column inches in newspapers.
Well, that's good because we are planning a side pod meetup there.
We
so
are.
You would recommend it then?
I absolutely, it's fascinating. You'll see things and you'll go, wow. And I mean, I was looking, I saw there was a thing about John Barnard, and I've been wondering for a couple of years what John Barnard's been up to, because he sort of disappeared off the face of the earth a few years ago. He's designing furniture now, which I discovered at the Science Museum. So.
For F1 furniture or
no, well, we're using F1 technology applied to furniture.
I see. Is that the very big table? I heard something about
the very
that.
Big table, yes, but right. The very big table that's 2 millimeters thick and 4 meters long and is completely rigid. I mean,
that was John Barnard.
Yep, absolutely.
I didn't know that. So, okay, so we're going next month, aren't we?
Yeah, April something, 15th, I think.
And presumably, obviously, the Science Museum has much more than just Formula One, but if you're a Formula One fan, it's worth popping along.
It is. It's got a McLaren upside down on the roof, which is great.
Always worth, you know, seeing that.
Would you
What I've always wanted to see, actually, I've always wanted to see one of these teams, instead of just talking about it, actually going out and doing it and proving you can run Formula One cars upside down. But I guess the insurance men are a bit upset
Could
about
you imagine?
It.
You'd have to get someone to agree to drive it, though.
You need a very long tunnel.
Well, that would be very hard because, yeah, they're a bit wimpy these days. But I think it was Toyota last year actually did a series of adverts with running a car upside down, but it was a virtual car, you know. Mm. It was like a big scale electric, not a scale electric. What's that thing we had when we were kids? Hot Wheels, you know.
Yeah, the loop thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that advert, yeah.
They did that. They did that, which was actually very funny. I mean, it appealed to my generation. I think modern generations didn't have the same sort of... It was awful, horrible plastic orange track, you know, with gassy little cars, but did go upside down. But Toyota actually used that quite well. I guess I have to be quite honest and say Toyota is wonderful because last year I went along to their 50th anniversary birthday party and they handed me a piece of paper. I was in a bit of a rush. And I rushed in and they handed me a bit of paper and said, answer these questions. It's a quiz. And I said, oh, all right. And I went tick, 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 and then rushed off back to work again because I sort of said hello to everybody I was supposed to. Hmm. And a little while later, they gave me a car.
What?
I won a Toyota Prius.
Wow.
Because I answered all the questions right, you see, apparently.
Wow.
You weren't even trying.
I was just busy. I didn't really think about it very much. And it was about the history of Toyota Motorsport. And I just guess I have a head full of useless information. So I have a Toyota Prius, thanks to them, and I love them. And I think actually, to be quite honest, it's a fabulous car. I mean, okay, it's not your fancy sports car with lots of sort of rorty-torty noises and squealy bits, but it's just a great car for getting around. I love it.
You say it's a head full of useless information, but I'd say
if it's useful you information.
Witness a car that is useful.
It did turn out to be in that case, but I mean, beyond that, you don't really need to know which Toyota team won the first World Championship Rally, do you? I mean,
talking of the Prius, actually, useful link, I guess, is how do you find the energy recovery on the Prius as an everyday driver, and do you think it has any relation to what Max is trying to do within Formula One?
Well, I think there's a huge relationship between the two, and I think anybody who's saying there isn't is being a bit bonkers. I mean, people argue different points for different reasons. There's political arguments about, you know, people don't want things to change because they happen to be very good at that particular moment or whatever, you know. But in terms of the technology that's available and is being developed by Formula One and its applications in Formula One, I think it's astonishing what can be done, particularly with the management of the power, the storing of the power, making things smaller and lighter and more efficient. And all that stuff will funnel through into the industry. And there's also the Williams system, which I think is by far the most exciting of the whole lot, which is, you know, the flywheel system, which has no batteries batteries are fundamentally, you have to throw them away at some point and they are polluting, therefore they are not perfectly green. Whereas the Williams flywheel is perfectly green because there's nothing but motion going on. So if they can get that into a form that can be put onto road cars at a cost-effective price, that would be brilliant.
There's obviously a lot more that can be done with KERS than is already being introduced this year, but it does seem like the teams are pushing back introducing KERS. They're all saying they're not going to run it straight away. Do you think it will catch on enough to bring it to the road industry?
anything that gives an advantage in Formula One, if it's a tenth of a second a lap, they'll introduce it as fast as they can. And the only reason they're not introducing it is that they have very strict safety measures, I suppose, is the answer. They have their own measures. So this is sufficiently reliable now to be used. And a lot of them have got to the point at the moment where they're not ready to do it under their own systems. It's too early. But as soon as they can, they will. And I think we'll see the races being won by cars which have KERS.
And you were saying that the Williams system is obviously beautiful because it doesn't have these battery systems. Any idea, you obviously have a Prius and you can see the benefit of not using batteries. How come some Formula One teams are still going down that route and not going purely down the mechanical route that Williams are?
Well, I think the answer to that was that it was because KERS is the speed at which it's been introduced is one of the questions that's been causing the problems. And I think they looked at it from a purely practical point of view, which is what's the fastest way we can do this. The Williams route may ultimately be the best one, but it's hellishly difficult to get it all organized because of the sort of speeds you're talking about. You know, I mean, we're talking about RPMs here of 75,000.
Sure.
And, you know, something like that blows up, you know, you'll take off half the front of the car. You know, so you have to have safety systems in place. You have to have vacuums going on. There's all kinds of things that make it very difficult to do. And Williams have just been braver than everybody else and said, we're going to go for this, because they think ultimately it has the more potential than everything else. And I think they're right. And it would be brilliant for Formula One if they suddenly turned into winners, having gone down this route, you know, by themselves being brave.
Yeah.
Because it would highlight this technology, and it would highlight some of the, I mean, this is one thing where Formula One fails hopelessly, and that is to tell the world what it's doing, which is why, to go back to the Science Museum, it's such a good thing, because there are lots of things going on that improve the world, make it a more environmentally friendly place, which Formula One is not making the most of. For example, there's this new French Grand Prix track that's been built, and it's an astonishing piece of work in terms of design, in terms of building something that's environmentally friendly. I mean, all the buildings are environmentally friendly, everything's carbon neutral, and goodness knows what. It's really quite astonishing. But there's a lot of this stuff going on all the time. And one of the other things, I think, you know, one of the greatest ideas that is floating around out there at the moment is the idea of having road cars that run around electric cars. And when you go home at night, you park your car and you plug it in, and the national grid sucks out the energy that's in your car and uses it for other things.
Right.
And in the morning when you get up, you turn on the power and you get enough power to get you going. And then you'll go on generating enough power to drive you around, and by the end of the day, you'll have a full battery. And by doing that, by having the right kind of power management skills, maybe the cars of the world could end up powering electricity grids.
Wow.
Around the world. This is the sort of ideas that are being kicked around in the scientific world. And so what you want is amazingly clever power management in order to do that in a million different homes. And the sort of things that Formula One teams are doing now with the KERS systems can perhaps be applied later on to much bigger problems like that. And so there's all kinds of things where there is environmental links which Formula One hasn't made the most of and is not telling the world about yet.
That's interesting. Firstly, my mind is slightly blown away by that concept, because that seems like a fantastic
It's really very interesting
idea.
Concept, isn't it?
If we could get Formula One to power the country, that'd be brilliant.
That would be even better.
Well, it would certainly give it a bit of a better image. I mean, you know, if you read the stuff that appears in the newspapers, the average stuff about Formula One is all about dolly birds and pollution, you know, and it's really not like that. There's a lot of very, very clever engineering, and that's, again, the Science Museum thing.
Do you know where the Science Museum idea came from? Who's pushing that? Was that, because I know McLaren are heavily involved in it. Did they instigate that, or are they just more willing than other teams to partake?
They've had a relationship with the Science Museum that goes back probably 8 to 10 years, I think. I mean, there's always been a McLaren in there. Every time I go, there's a McLaren in there. And it's, I think that was, it was one of Häkkinen's cars, so that's how old it is. And I think they've also got this company, which they started a couple of years ago, called McLaren Applied Technologies, which is at the forefront of some of these new ideas. But there are other teams doing stuff as well. I think they're a little bit more advanced, just because they're a bigger organization. You know, they're doing carbon fiber composite seats for the U.S. Marine Corps in case they get blown up on landmines and things like this.
Wow.
And they have wonderful things like there's a telemetry system for patients, outpatients. So you can basically go around the world, you know, and have your heart whatever bits you like being monitored radio or whatever it is at the hospital, so they can see if you're about to blow up, you know, like an engine on the back straight. You know, if you're about to blow up, they can call you in. So there's all kinds of ideas like that which are being developed.
But at the moment, without this Science Museum, you and I would presumably not get to hear about it.
Basically, I've been trying to find out a lot more about this stuff in recent years, but McLaren have been they're beginning to get a bit more open about it, but they're a bit sort of cagey to start with. They didn't want to make a big fuss about it. Until it was more established, I think. But I think the museum exhibition is a sort of step in the direction of let's tell the world about what we're actually doing here. And I think that's true. Williams have got a thing going at the moment with Airbus and Rolls-Royce aero engines and various missile companies and things, where they're developing the next generation of CFD, computational fluid dynamics. And they're all working together on this. to stop a bunch of six different bunches of engineers doing exactly the same work and all spending money. So they've all got together and said, well, let's just work together and we'll all get the benefits of it. And so you've got schemes like that, which are, you know, fascinating as well. And there's all kinds of little schemes going on where engineers are going off and doing things. So Honda was very good at this because they had the Honda R&D company in Japan, which is a very weirdly structured company where you have 1,000 engineers sort of sitting around just thinking and going, well, what can I do to make things new and different? And if one of them comes up with an idea, he thinks, oh, no, that could go on the Formula One car, he'd go up to the boss of the Honda R&D and say, I want to put this on the Formula One car. And they'd look at it and go, yeah, that's a good idea. And so they would then come in, and sometimes they'd work and sometimes they wouldn't work. But you have all these new kind of technologies and some fairly wild, you know, really out there stuff being used just to, you know, to just further the breed, if you like. So Formula One's not just about going around in circles and winning lots of money. But the failure has been to tell the world exactly how, you know, how clever it is.
If you had to point the finger at anyone for that failing, would you suggest that maybe the FIA could have done more? Because I haven't heard their name mentioned in association with this, with the Science Museum project, and I would have imagined that would be up their street.
Well, that's an interesting argument, isn't it? I mean, it could be them. You could say it's the teams themselves. You could say it's Bernie, who is the promoter of Formula One. But when all is said and done, you know, we love to divide them off into groups and say, well, they're fighting this lot and they're fighting this lot. The fundamental problem of Formula One is that they've never worked together because they're too busy with, usually it's egos, the various egos bouncing off one another. But they've never worked together like a single company would work together. And they have to. And I think they're realizing that now. And I think, you know, the birth of FOTA, giving the teams a proper voice and staying together and not being divided up. And I think just the general sort of corporatization of the sport, they're realizing that Formula One has to compete with football. It has to compete with any activity that happens on a Sunday afternoon. You know, it has to compete with church. You've got to be, well, it's true. You know, you have to be competitive with whatever it is that people can do. So they have to be competitive for teenage kids. They've got to be competitive with the internet. They've got to be competitive with horse racing or whatever it is. You know, and instead of fighting among themselves, they need to work together to make sure that everybody, or as many people as possible, are watching their show and, you know, getting the full story.
On that subject, seeing as you just brought up the internet, there was some talk a while back relating to USGP, which are now renamed US Grand Prix Engineering. They were talking about opening up the factory to the fans more on the internet. So they were going to put webcams within the factory, and they were going to do a lot more in terms of relating to the fans who are watching in, on their armchairs or on the internet. I presume you're for that idea. And do you think other teams should be looking at what USGPE are suggesting that they might do?
Well, I think the whole sport should be looking at it. I think one of the most impressive things I've seen in recent months is, and this is kind of bizarre because obviously I live abroad, so I wasn't aware of it, but Rory, the racing car, which is on, I believe, on TV in Britain and in various other countries, is the most brilliant piece of publicity for Formula One. You know, that's available out there, because what it's doing is capturing a whole generation at the age when they're very receptive. So, you know, the sort of 2 to 5 year olds are getting into racing without even knowing they're doing it. And, you know, Formula One has been very poor at bringing in new people. And the demographic has been very much a sort of rather stodgy 35 to 45 year old bloke with enough money to think about it. You know, and that's getting a bit old. So they need to find ways of moving in the direction of the youngsters. And F1 in schools has been quite good for doing that, you know, getting people into the whole engineering concept. And so there's lots of different ways it can be done. The internet's obviously one that would help. But, you know, when you're dealing with people in their 70s, 60s and 70s, and, you know, we all have parents and we know what it's like trying to teach them to deal with the internet and computers. It's not an easy thing to do. It's just so new. And their view is, well, why the hell do I need this? You know, what's it going to do for me? And I think that's what Bernie looks at it and he goes, you know, well, what's it going to do for me? Where do I make my money?
Sure.
And you know, until you can see ways that it will work for you, you're just going to throw your hands up and walk away because it's too complicated. And I think that that's a generational thing, and it needs to. You can't change people of that mindset. My great grandfather thought the moon was made of cheese, and you know, well, it's true. You know, and the concept that, I mean, I remember in the 1960s, you know, when they were starting to talk about putting men on the moon, I'm told that he just said, well, it's ridiculous. Why on earth would you want to put men on the moon? You know, what value can that be, spending all that money? Because the moon's made of cheese. He couldn't change it. He was 90 years old.
Sure.
You know?
Yes. But again, to me, that just sounds obviously completely preposterous because I grew up in a generation when after...
The moon's not made of cheese.
We'd already been there by the time we grew up. So, yeah, I completely understand. If you were...
Well, I wonder if it's to do with... If there was more access to Formula One, you might get more people interested because at the moment you've got... I mean, in the UK, you've got Autosport, you've got Goodwood, and you've got a really expensive Grand Prix, and that's about it.
In terms of events?
Yeah, you don't get to see the teams. You know, testing is being taken away rapidly.
But there's two arguments here. One is that one should open it up, and that would be wonderful. And the other argument is that by making it more exclusive, you make it more popular because it becomes something that's different and glamorous. And if you take the glamour away... you know, glamour consists of a certain element of mystery. You know, you can't all walk into the catwalks in the fashion world and just sit there and gawp at these things. They don't let you in. You know, there are elements to it which are actually. I know it may not be a very popular view among the fans who want to get up, you know, get down and dirty with the race cars, but when all is said and done, a lot of the glamour comes from the fact that it is untouchable. Now. I'm not saying that's necessarily right, and I'm not saying that everybody does as much as they could to open it up to the fans, but I think people get more excited about the people involved than they do about the machines. There is always an element. There's a percentage of the race fans who want to go and perv at the cars, you know, and go and play with the air intakes and all that sort of like, you know.
I know someone like that.
But, yeah, no, but that, I mean, that's just that there is a percentage, but it's not a huge percentage. So... People say they want to be there and close into the action. They want to look at the cars. Yes, that's up to a point they do. But what they really want is access to the people, because the people are the point of interest. And I think one of the big failures, particularly with the drivers, is that they are just not accessible enough. Because most of them are pretty nice people, but they are so protected, and you know they're always worrying about dealing with their engineers, or you know they're really not good at relating to the public. If you compare them to the Americans, where the culture is, you know, get in, meet the people, and they'll sit there for 4 hours at a time signing autographs in America. You know, you'd never, ever, ever get a Formula One driver who'd sit there for 4 hours, you know, because his hair would get out of place and it would just be all too much. And his manager would say, come on, I've got to get a helicopter somewhere else, you know. But the point is that there's a mentality problem, and they're forgetting that the customer is the person who ultimately pays their money. They might get round to that a little bit more because the money's going to start coming down soon and they're going to have to start working for it a little bit more because teams simply can't afford to pay them the kind of money they're being paid at the moment. So they've really been rather spoiled, and I don't think they give enough back.
I think in the FOTA proposals that came out recently, they want to basically mandate that drivers have to have autograph sessions. And it just seems silly that you have to mandate something like that. But then if it helps...
It's the only way. It's the only way. I mean, there are drivers who just do the most ludicrous things. I mean, you know, the most valuable thing to any sensible racing driver are the crew of people who work on his car. They are the people who he should love. He should make sure that they are fed, watered, happy. You know, if one of them has a wife who's got a problem and needs to be in hospital, the driver should come up with the cash and make sure that those people love him. And if he says, okay, boy, jump off the cliff, they will go and jump off a cliff for him. And the great champions all have guys like that. They will just follow you to the edge of the earth and then they'll jump off with you. But there was one driver I know who, you know, his relationship with the team consisted of twice a year he would helicopter in, he would land, walk, or rather march to the elevator, up to the boss's office, have his 20-minute meeting, and leave by helicopter again. Never went to visit the team, never related to them. And you know, where do these people come from? The problem is that they're not beaten around the head when they're young. They're wrapped up in cotton wool and told they're wonderful. And, you know, in America, they've got to get up there and say ridiculous things like, you know, my DuPont Ford was real good today, kind of stuff, which you don't hear Formula One drivers saying. I mean, it might be crass and corny, but that's what the sponsors want to hear you saying.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got to learn that it's all very well being, I'm a Formula One star, I can't possibly do that. Excuse me, I've just got to go because my carbon composite super platinum watches, I'm just going to do something else. You know, it's really about relating to people, because people is what it's all about. That's what they want. People want people.
The drivers came out in the recent spat about the upping of their fees to the FIA. Did they come out of that looking pretty bad, didn't they? Do you think they learned anything from, as a, you know, do you think it took any lessons away from the fact that putting out a press release and bellyaching about the how much money they're earning and how much they have to give to the FIA and the way that the fans reacted to that? Do you think they took any of that on board, or did it not make the slightest bit of difference?
Well, I think they took it on board because they backed down and shut up. I don't know how they ever came up with the idea in the first place, because anybody who's, I mean, one of the problems with Formula One drivers is most of them believe that motor racing began the day they started in it, and they don't have any reference or knowledge in history. They don't understand that, you know, the sport's been going on for 100 and X number of years, and that they are just a part of it. I mean, Michael Schumacher used to say things like, I don't know if this is the first time this has been a Ferrari 1-2. You know, hello. but this is the sort of thing. They don't have a view of it. So if you actually study the history of drivers' strikes in motor racing in general, they've all been hopeless flops. Because you can't stay together as a unit. And if you can stay together as a unit, you can always be replaced, because everybody wants to be a Formula One driver. And, you know, if you all walk out one day, every man in GP2 will go, me.
Sure.
And so you can never win. And so it's pointless to even go down that path. And then putting out sort of saber-rattling kind of press releases. It was just, I suppose it's a sign of the fact that these people live in a rather rarefied world, that they don't understand the realities of it all. And, you know, it's one of those lessons that has to be learned, and I think they've probably taken a few lessons from it.
Given how quickly they did back down, do you think Max might look at that and say, well, actually, maybe we'll just extract a bit more money out of them now? Do you think they've lost, they've lost twice?
I wouldn't have thought he'd be that. I mean, well, who knows? you know. At the end of the day, I don't think that the drivers should be paying that sort of money with a super license. I think that should be paid for by the money that is generated from commercial rights. But the way that things are structured at the moment, that's how it is. And, you know, power works is that the person who's got the power makes things happen. And at the moment, Max has the power ultimately. And so he says, this is what you do, and that's what you got to do, because that's how the power structure works. Now, if Max turns around and says to Bernie, well, actually, in the perfect world, you should be paying for this or that, and we need to restructure it, then it can be changed, and things can be done in a more so sensible fashion. But I think all he was doing was looking for the path of least resistance to find the money he needed for the job he had to do.
And he did that.
Yes, and I think also, let's be honest here, I mean, they are earning an awful lot of money. Not all of them, okay, there's the occasional anomaly, you know, where there's a guy who's very good, like Kubica's only earning whatever he was, you know, but they're still, you know, the poor bloke, he's only earning less than $1 million a year. Hello? I
mean, my heart bleeds.
My heart bleeds for you, poor old Robert. I mean, okay, and you may have a short career, but I mean, you know, actually it's really safe out there nowadays. That doesn't mean it'll be always very safe, and it doesn't mean that people won't get hurt or killed in the future. But it's been a long time that people, you know, Formula One drivers can pretty much walk out of any wreck there is these days.
As Kubica did.
Doesn't mean that will go on like that, and we should never be in the least bit complacent about it. But this is not the 1960s where they're dying at a rate of one every two races. This is not the danger money that it was in those days. I mean, that's fundamentally the core of it. So why are they earning these vast sums of money? It's because they are promotional tools.
Yeah.
Well, if they're promotional tools, they should be more toolish and more user-friendly, because right now they're not user-friendly.
Yeah.
And they're not being used to the maximum of their value. And their value is selling products. And so that's where they need to have a look at what they do and say, I've got to make myself really valuable, and then I can go on selling things. I mean, look at Mika Häkkinen. He's gone on He's working as an ambassador to Johnny Walker. And he's having a lovely time. He gets to travel around the world a bit, as much as he likes. He gets paid a decent whack of money, and he doesn't have to do very much. You know, he just goes along and has parties. You know, what a great job. Now, how did he get that job? He got that job because they couldn't get the drivers, who are actually in the cars with Johnny Walker written on the side, because they were available, you know, for one day a year or something. Even if you're a big sponsor, that's all you get them for.
Right.
So you have to go and find somebody else to do it for you, which is nuts if you think about it. I mean, it's great for Mika Häkkinen, but it's nuts if you're thinking about, you know, well, we're putting all this money in and we're getting one day off these people. So they have to be more user-friendly if they want to earn the same kind of money, I think. And I think that, you know, all in all, it goes back to the same point I made before, which is that everybody, and that goes for the press, it goes for the drivers, it goes for the teams, it goes for the FIA, it goes for Bernie, it goes for the bankers in the background. Everybody is in this together, and we have to find ways to work together. And, you know, there are all kinds of problems. You know, the costs involved in reporting Formula One. I mean, journalists will talk about it a little bit, but, you know, the actual costs of going to the races in the course of a year with a recession going on, if you're a freelance, you pay it all yourself. If you're working for a big newspaper or a magazine, they pay. Mm. But it doesn't take a long time before they start going, well, hang on a minute, do you really need to go to China?
Yeah.
And do you really need to do this? It's a real problem because wherever we go, hotel prices are astronomical. I mean,
because
just laughable. Because the people see this rich circus coming to town and think, oh, we can charge anything we like. These people will pay it. Oh, and while you're at it, it's a 5-night minimum, you know. So, you know, you go to Malaysia where you want to spend maybe 3 days and they say, well, it's a 5-night minimum, sorry. But I don't want to spend another 2 days sitting in a jungle full of palm trees. I want to go home. And they don't really understand that that is massive negative publicity for them. Because, you know, why would you want to be sitting there when you don't have to? And certainly, why would you want to be paying for hotel rooms you can't use? You know, there are all kinds of ridiculous scams that go on because they can get away with it.
Sure.
And Formula One should actually be uniting. And the teams, too. I mean, some of the teams, they'll talk about hotel bills in Monaco, which are just terrifying. You know, they have 7-night minimums in Monte Carlo because they are the ultimate bandits.
Goodness me.
But, you know, 7-night minimums at $500 a night. You know, that's normal.
That, to me, that's an unbelievable sum. I mean, I wouldn't even consider. We just couldn't afford it. Is that, I mean, how do fans afford that? Or is that, do they just...
Well, they don't. It's very simple. The fans, either European fans, they camp. If you have places like Kuala Lumpur, they go stay in the city, which is, you know, however far away it is, 20 miles away. But you have places like Manicor, you know, where there just weren't enough fans. And that's happening in Spa. They can't find the fans because Michael Schumacher's campervan army doesn't come anymore. You know, and French people might want to go up and watch the Belgian Grand Prix. But to do it and back in a day is pretty hard work from Paris.
Yeah.
And, you know, they really don't want to go and camp in a Belgian forest where it's inevitably going to rain. And inevitably there'll be a bunch of beer-swilling Germans nearby, you know, singing songs and annoying them. So, you know, this is... Well, it's true. I mean, when all is said and done, you know, Formula One has to be in places where people can go. It has to be places where they can afford to go. And some people, there are always some people who will say, right, well, I'm going to spend $1,000 for my weekend of the year, and this will be the big thing for me. And that's terrific. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that where you will get people to afford it. But you look at the prices of any of the tickets, really, you know. Silverstone, what does that cost? It's huge amounts of money, isn't
More
it?
More than in we real, can afford this
real
year.
Real world, yeah. Yeah.
Just going back, actually, just something you mentioned a second ago was the cost of the cost you as a freelance journalist to go. And there was you did a blog post on your blog last week you did it, and it caused a little bit of controversy. I think there was a lot of comments on it, and there was a lot of comments on our site. I think most people actually who read it misinterpreted what you were trying to say. What you're basically saying is the cost of doing this is astronomical for you as a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not getting cheaper. What you didn't really go into on the blog is how there might be a way of solving it. Is there any way that Formula One could get together and do things like reduce the cost of hotels
There are. We've been beating some of these people around the head in the last couple of years. I've been particularly having a go at Bahrain, and they've responded to the treatment, and they've introduced a media hotel, which is very sensibly priced. You know, $100 a night for the media, and that's good because that means that we can look at it and go, "Oh, thank God for that. We'll save ourselves 700 euros for the week." You know, ludicrous numbers like that. But yes, of course you can. Most of the American races have media hotels where people can go, and it's cheaper, not more expensive. And they go there and they get all you want. You don't need to have 5-star hotels, glitzy bars and swimming pools and naked ladies wandering around. What you want is a hotel with a bed in it, which has internet.
And a cup of tea, maybe.
Well, a cup of tea would be nice. But I mean, if it's somewhere near a vaguely a restaurant where you can eat something that doesn't have things crawling out of it, you know, whatever. You need food and sleep and access to the world, and that's all you need.
There was a lot of controversy last year with within the paddock. The Wi-Fi access costs vary, don't they, from race to race? And you're obviously going to know more about this than us, but they're like,
it's still outrageous.
Did we get the impression that some people were ripping off the media within the media compound?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And who is responsible for that, and who could bring those prices down?
Well, basically, the FIA is bringing those prices down. They're just telling people that is not acceptable. They're working on the theory that $100 a weekend is acceptable. My argument is that's rubbish. It's not acceptable. I mean, it should be free. We're doing them a favor. That's absolutely why we're going. But I know we have one of the things that we've done. I used to run pirate networks. I would go and sign up for my access, and I'd run my own internet, wireless internet network in the press office, and anyone could use it. It wasn't as effective necessarily, but it did sort of make the point to the people that you're ripping us off. And they couldn't really do anything about it. Some of them did and blocked it and stuff like that. And I would walk into the FIA office every weekend and I'd say I'd like to complain about the price of the internet access because it's wrong. But, you know, it takes time to do these things. You can't make it happen overnight. But it's just it's the mindset. Because the circuits are saying, well, you know, we pay so much money to get this race in. We have to try and recoup a little bit here and there because we don't have any of the signage left. We don't have this and we don't have that. So we'll just rip off the journalists a bit because they can afford it. It's just, it's all to do with the mentality, the same thing again, of everybody trying to find ways of ripping off everybody else, where in fact they should be turning around and saying, well, no, let's work together and make this right. And, you know, that's the hard thing, is to change the habits of I don't know how long it's been going on for 25 years like that, you know. So, you know, it just doesn't, if you think about it, this is an argument I've had with Bahrain on many occasions. Look, what is there in Bahrain that I'm going to write about and say, you chaps out there in the world have got to come and see? I mean, really, what is there? It's just a very, very, very flat piece of sand. And it has a couple of nice buildings at one end of it. And that's it, really. So in order for me to be keen and enthusiastic about Bahrain, they have to be really nice people, because and you know, you have to see things that you say, oh well, that's, it's sort of quaint and nice, and you know, but if you go there and they rip you off, or they give you a hard time, or they shake you down with too much security or whatever it is, why in the world are you going to say anything nice about these people? And it's not because it's really just, you know, give me a reason to promote you. I'm here to promote the sport. You want the sport to help promote your city, your region, whatever it is. Give me a reason to say good things about you, because in some of these places it's really hard to find a good reason to say. and it really is, you know. I remember when we first went to Malaysia. And if you only ever go to the hotel and to the racetrack, you don't get a very good impression of Malaysia. You know, it's just you drive through endless miles of palm oil trees and you arrive at the airport, which is the racetrack. You go back to the hotel, da 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 da, and you don't get any good impression. But you know, one day, if you turn off and you go and visit these amazing new cities that that Malaysia built, as part of the sort of process of trying to modernize. And it's like being in Gotham City. I mean, it's unbelievable. You walk around with your mouth open. But, you know, nobody ever showed us that. We actually discovered it by accident, you know. And it's the same thing about Formula One not being very efficient. Some of the racetrack promotion people are not very efficient either, because you're not getting the reason that you're going there. I mean, I have no idea why we go to Shanghai. Absolutely no idea. I mean, it's a big Chinese city. Great. Nobody goes there, you know, unless they're told to.
That's the impression we got. I mean, they don't make it easy for you to get into the country either, do they?
Well, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare to get into the country on a journalist visa. And, of course, you don't dare not go as a journalist, you know, because the last thing you want to be arrested is being a journalist in China without a visa, because then you'll go to, you know, wherever they take people like that, and you'll be a spy, and that will be no fun at all. So you go and spend. It's absolutely horrible trying to get Chinese visas, but that's the way of the world. You know, we're going there. We're trying to promote them. I'm trying to think, why the hell am I trying to promote this place? But what the hell? You know, I'll do the best I can. And there are bits of it which are really nice and lively and lovely and you know, all the rest of it. But you've got to be given a reason to like a place. I mean, Montreal or Melbourne, it's patently obvious why you want to go there, and you want to tell people, this is a great place. You know, this is a really great place. It's a happening town. It's fun. It's, you know, it's got everything going for it. That's easy. But we know Istanbul, there's another one. I mean, goodness gracious me, what on earth are we doing there? You know, it's yes, the Bosphorus is all very jolly and they've got lots of old buildings, but, you know, most of them are falling down. You know, why would people want to go there and be tourists unless they happen to be experts in the Byzantine Empire, you know? But that's what it boils down to.
Talking of promoting Formula One, you're doing a pretty good job. I mean, we mentioned in the introduction that you have GrandPrix.com. You recently started up a blog, which I think you were promoting the French Grand Prix on there recently.
I don't know if I'm promoting it. I just happened to come across some photographs before everyone else, which is always nice, a joy.
It was, yeah, the exclusive. Yeah.
Absolutely exclusive, and then, funnily enough, nobody's even got them yet because they daren't steal them off me because they don't quite sure where I got them from. Which is
excellent.
It makes a great change because I'm very tired. Anyone out there listening, I'm very tired with people stealing it all.
Have we got that impression from your blog post? Why out of interest, just out of curiosity, did you choose to put it on your blog and not on your GrandPrix.com website?
Well, because the blog is a blog, and GrandPrix.com is really a news site,
right?
And that's the, you know, there is a difference between the two, where I you know, you can have a lot more sort of opinion and blogs are more about life, aren't they? You know, to me, GrandPrix.com is about news, occasional features, and a few columns, which have a certain amount of personal feeling to them. But, you know, it's much more sort of humanoid, sure, if you like. And that was a particular rant I've had for a long time about, particularly people who are basically commercializing the theft. A lot of people misunderstood what I meant when I wasn't attacking people who run blogs at all.
No,
people who run blogs, that's fine. I'm all for that. People are allowed to have their opinions about Formula One. It can be total rubbish. It doesn't matter. They're allowed to do it. What I object to is people who are stealing from the valid news sources, and are then commercializing that and pretending and conning the world into believing that they are, in fact, they have some idea what they're talking about, which they don't. And there's a few of those, and it just drives me absolutely insane watching these people putting out, because what they do is they suck in all the people who've got money to feed the freelancers, and basically puts the pressure on the freelancers because the money that used to be out there isn't there anymore.
We are aware of one of those such companies, and we've mentioned them on the show in the past, and we've mentioned them on the website. How many beyond the main one are there doing this then? Are there other companies out there doing
not
something
many.
Similar? Just the one.
When all is said and done, no, there are a couple of others who don't have people at races and who sell stuff to all kinds of other sites, but they have a little bit more credibility than the main offenders. But you know, there are a few. I mean, I don't think that any of these organisations should be doing that, really.
No.
I don't think Haymarket Publishing should be doing that either. I mean, they went through a phase of doing it, and they're not doing it so much nowadays, but, you know, of just basically spreading the wings everywhere and shutting down a lot of other people.
Sure.
But that's, you know, in a way, it's commercial, the commercial realities of life. But, you know, you are actually, you're destroying what you're feeding off, because unless you have those good sources of information to steal, you won't have the valuable information, so you can, it becomes harder and harder to actually tell the world that you're an expert, because you know less and less. And so in the overall scheme of things, the quality of Formula One news will go down if this is allowed to go on.
Well,
it's just an inevitability.
The issue we have, I think, as fans, is that it's not only the fact that, I mean, I can see from your point of view that your work is being stolen, it's being represented as somebody else's work, and you're not getting due credit for that. But there have been times in the past where a certain news agency have missed out key facts of a story in order to turn it into something that it isn't. And therefore, they're not only are they ripping off the people, the journalists that are writing these stories, they're also essentially ripping off the fans because they're giving them duff information deliberately in order to get a good headline or to sell more of their regurgitated news.
That's absolutely true. And they'll you know, you add the extra spin to get the headline, to get the people to look at it, and it's all down to the number of clicks you get, you know. And this is the sensationalism or the sensationalization of Formula One reporting is another thing which gets my goat. Because, you know, the level of serious reporting that goes on, the really good stories, you know, Jenson Button's girlfriend or whatever it is, the latest one is really of very little interest to me. I mean, people might be interested in it in terms of going back to the conversation about people who are interested in people. But it's not a motor racing story, if you know what I mean. It's not big news compared to the fact that the Brawn is way faster than everybody else, or McLaren are doing amazing things with technology. You know, this is much more interesting to me, and just the sort of trivialization of the news and what I call the he said she said school of journalism, which is, you know, today Jenson Button slammed David Coulthard for da 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 da, and then the following day it's David Coulthard denies that Jenson Button this and slams him back, you know. Yes. And so great, we've created two news stories of absolutely zero value, and we've got a bunch of clicks.
Yes.
And people have gone, oh, this is bollocks. Yeah. I'm not going to read this anymore. And that's what's, you know, that's trivializing the whole thing.
Yes.
And because it's very hard to have a news story every day, let alone 10.
Yes. Yeah. And something we picked up over Christmas, when you're promising to deliver 10 Formula One, unique Formula One news stories every day of the year, when Formula One shuts down over Christmas, I mean, everybody knows Formula One.
There's not a chance of doing it.
It just switches off over for those for at least 7 days.
But if you don't talk to anybody, if you don't talk to anybody and can invent it, that's fine. But I mean, the teams, the sponsors, they are ballistic about these people as well, because they have to deal with the fallout of, you know, if you have a story that someone's slamming somebody else and it appears in 20 places, they have to deal with that.
Sure.
And, you know, the sponsors get into a panic about it and they ring up the team and say, why is this happening? And teams say, this isn't true. And entire Formula One press conferences are wasted discussing things that are not true. People have to ask the question because their editors say, oh, don't forget to ask about this. And you say, it's not true. And they say, it doesn't matter. It's been in the newspapers. It must be true.
Yeah, because the thing is, where it gets syndicated off, the more sites it gets syndicated off of, the more people believe it. Because if you say it on one site, okay, but if the second site syndicates from the same news agency, then you've got two sites reporting the same information.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what you want is you want to have responsible agencies like the Reuters and, you know, the long-established Reuters, AP, and these sort of people who that's good old-fashioned style reporting. They don't put any trash on there. They don't do 20 a day, because you can't do 20 a day. It's just not possible. And that's, you know, GrandPrix.com, you'll see that. You can see three or four, and some days they'll be, you know, right out there on the edge in terms of relevance, but you know, you do what you can do.
Sure.
And you can't do more than that. You can't make news when there isn't any. And you know, this is the sort of drive of the internet. Everything is up to the minute, and it's got to happen. It's got to have this. It's got to have this. We've got to be following every inch of the way. It's nuts. It's crazy. You know, we can't do that. We just have to take a deep breath and say, okay, it's just two or three stories a day or whatever it is. It's just trivialization, really. And that really annoys me, because it undermines so much of what is good about Formula One and, you know, what people are interested in, because after reading 20 trivial stories, you'll probably get a bit bored and go off and do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if everything you read about, you know, if every story that you hear and every headline that you read turns out to be rubbish, I mean, in the end, you're just going to go and find a sport where it's not the case, where you go and find something else to do where you're not reading a load of rubbish that turns out to be completely untrue within 24 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the problem exists in lots of different areas. I know that in the cinema, there's a lot of rubbish sites out there, you know, talking about what Jennifer Aniston's up to this week. There is, I suppose, in the long term, these things will balance out and people will know where to come for their solid news. But if you're new and you have no idea and you're just walking in there, you're going to get sucked into this to this culture, because you just don't know any different. And how do you find out what is good? It takes a long time to do that.
It does.
I mean, I remember when I first started reading motor racing stories in newspapers back in the 1970s, when I was in my teens, I had no idea. It never crossed my mind there would be specialist magazines on the subject. I just didn't even think about it. You know, I knew there were car magazines, but I never sort of paid much attention to them. I just read it in the newspapers, and the Times and the Telegraph had a bit about motor racing. I thought, that's great. I want to know more about this. How do I find out? And literally, sort of, it was looking at the shelves, going, "Blimey, look at that! There's a thing called Autosport. Oh, what's this one called Motor News?" You know, and it took a long time before I sort of found my way through, because I didn't have any sort of guidance. I know that sounds a bit crazy, but if you have no guidance and you don't know, and now it's way more complicated than that, because, you know, you go out on the web and there's 1,000 places you can go. You don't know who to believe and who not to believe.
Well, it used to take an awful lot of money to publish a magazine. It still does, I guess. So to have that much money, you're almost buying a certain amount of credibility to have a magazine on the shelf. It costs nothing to put a website up, and it costs very little to drive traffic to a website with a couple of headlines, and therefore the cost of creating the news is dropped to such a point that it is almost impossible just from looking at a website. You can't look at the design of a website and say that's more credible because it has a better design. Mm-hmm. That effectively doesn't mean anything. So there is no other way other than investigating and trialing error at the moment to find out who is credible.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you Googled F1 right now, one of the top websites that appears on the first page, probably within the top five, is a site that's basically syndicating one of those news agencies that reports rubbish. And so even relying on something like Google is no guarantee of credibility.
No, you can't rely on any of that. I mean, you know, the other thing is, of course, Formula One is such a loose term. I mean, I don't know if anyone out there has actually gone to FormulaOneone.com ever, which sells windscreen
right.
shades that you stick on. You know, this is the marvelous thing about Formula One. It is, you know, everyone's got TM written all over it. And the sport doesn't own any of that stuff. It's you know, it doesn't even own FormulaOneone.com. You know, that's how silly it is. And if you go to France, you'll see Formula One hotels. And if you go to this, you'll see this and that. And, you know, they're trying to get control of it. But, you know, it's just one of those things that there's just too many of them in the world to make it very easy to do that. I mean, we could do what MotoGP did and sort of start with a massive rebranding exercise. But I think the bottom line is you just have to live with what you've got and just go ahead as best you can and not try and claim too much. But it's all again about working together and working in the right direction and closing ranks against these silly people outside who are working against the sport, if you like.
On that note, that sounds like a really good way to end this conversation. I just wanted to promote some of the stuff you're doing, though, because we've mentioned GrandPrix.com and we've mentioned the blog, and you can find the blog. It's
joesayward.wordpress.com, whatever. But if you Google it, it's called Joe Sayward's Grand Prix blog.
You're not linking to it from your GrandPrix.com site at the moment, are you?
No.
Are you planning to do that, or are you planning to keep them as separate entities?
I'm keeping them as separate entities at the moment.
Okay.
One is GrandPrix.com and one is Joe Sayward's blog, and the two are not interrelated. But certainly, if you're you can get to it from Grand Prix Plus. You can get to it from the Morion Val Press site. You can get from it from various places. But basically, if you use Google and do Joe Sayward Grand Prix blog, it will come up straight away.
And we will put a link in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Sure you can get to that. The other thing we haven't mentioned, which I'm presuming you're going to start ramping up work on after Melbourne, is GP Plus.
No, I should be ramping up a bit of that this week, actually.
Really? You're doing that, you work on that ahead of the Grand Prix?
Well, we're going to have a preview issue.
Right.
Which I'll have to do this week, which is, basically it's an e-magazine of about 60 to 70 pages, depending on how much energy we've got. It comes out something between 4 and 6 hours after the race ends.
We, in this instance, is yourself and David Tremaine, who does
some
writing
for it. David Tremaine and Paul-Henri Caillé does the photographs. Mm-hmm. And we occasionally have other people writing for it, but we found that small is beautiful, and you know, it's a bit like in the army. You know, if you want a job done, get 3 people to do it rather than 100. And so we can get things out much quicker than people who've got more people working on it, because we don't have any of the arty farty blokes, you know, with plastic red glasses on and pigtails getting in the way, telling us, "No, you can't do that." You know, got to have designed differently, and you know, production managers and all that sort of rubbish.
Do tell us how three of you managed to produce 70 pages, I presume that's A4 pages of content. Before, according to your website, it's available guaranteed by 9 a.m. the Monday after a race.
Well, that's the latest point, yeah. And we do. I mean, the fastest one we did was 4.5 hours after the race, and it was it's easy, really.
How?
David and I write. He edits because I'm hopeless editor, and always have been. I do the layout, and because I know how to lay stuff out, because I spent years at Autosport doing layout on the pages as well as being the reporting. You know, in those days it was with the scalpels and glue, but you know, you learn how to lay out pages.
Nothing changes,
all you do have to do nowadays with electronic means is to just do it. I haven't had any training, I just learned how to do it. And so we just knock out the pages and you know, it whizzes through, you get the report in, you slap that in the page, you put some photographs over the top, stick the results in, and you have the features pre-prepared as much as possible. Stick in a bit of news. It's just David and I. It's kind of strange, really. But in the 1980s, he was Motoring News. I was Autosport. We were bitter enemies, in fact. But what we were doing was the same thing, which is we were the news hounds of that era, and we were producing things in a big hurry, and it was a good competition. And we actually started in Formula 3 together as opponents, and ended up in Formula 1 as opponents, and eventually started working together in various different magazines around the world, and then working together, you know, for our own magazine. And that's how it happened. But we just have a strange set of skills that work, in as much as we've done all this stuff and it's second nature to us. The only slightly weird thing is that two sort of 40 to 50 year old blokes actually dealing with the electronic side of thing is a bit rare, but that's just because we have sort of open minds, I suppose, and we're not frightened by it. We just sort of go and try and do it and see what happens.
And what time do you, I mean, you said you managed to get this out 4 hours after a race, but if it takes longer, what time do you end up going to sleep on a Sunday night?
Ah, well, that's another story, isn't it? What is sleep? one of the biggest problems we have is actually not producing it. It's uploading it afterwards, because we have very often very big files are very hard to deal with, and a lot of hotels have very small bandwidth, and a lot of the Grand Prix press rooms have very poor bandwidth as well. There is another country which it won't let you upload any file above a certain size, so it's known as the Great Firewall of China. And we leave China on the night of the race. We go to the airport, and actually last year I was sitting in the lounge at the airport laying out the pages with Jarno Trulli sitting nearby, going, what's this lunatic doing? And basically getting on a plane to go to a country where you can upload it.
Wow, that's dedication.
Well, it's not dedication. It's just getting the job done, you know. And it's a bargain of the century. It costs £25 for the year, which you get 20 issues, which is a preview and a season roundup at the end of it, plus one after each race. And, you know, there are other people out there who are producing things that are free. And, you know, it's hard work. But, you know, it's like being back in Autosport, I suppose, in 1950 when it first started. You know, you have to get people to go on the web and read this stuff and get into the habit of doing it. And once they've done that, then they'll start buying it and it'll become normal, because it's not expensive. So we hope to grow it and make it into a proper magazine that will compete. We're going into our third season now. Just to have a magazine that's way ahead of the paper mags. Now, obviously, you know, we can't go as big as some of those can do, but in terms of purely F1, you can't get anything quicker. And you've got some good people, you've got some good photographs, it's a pretty bloody good deal, really, I think.
I think you can safely say that. We're going to go and subscribe in a minute.
Yeah, you take PayPal, don't you?
Well, I'll know, you know. I will know.
it's PayPal, isn't it, you take?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. We're familiar with that. We can deal with PayPal.
You just pay on the PayPal and you will get, in fact, you won't, this year, you won't even get notification. All you have to do is go X number of hours after the race. Just go, you'll get your own login and just go in and pick it off.
I think we should do that.
You download your PDFs and you can read it there, and then you get the whole story of the race. And, the speed of production means that you don't have 2 or 3 hours going around sort of, you know, chatting to everybody after the race, but you do have enough to know what's going on. And you're going to get the same sort of stuff you're going to get appearing in the paper mags 4 days later. So, you know, logically speaking, it's a good place to be. Because if you look at the web, the reason we started it was because, you know, the web does a lot of stuff, but it doesn't do very good analysis of races. It doesn't give you a record of what happened. And that's another thing we think is very important. A lot of these mags are based on the fact that they're written around the fact that everyone's seen the race on the telly.
Sure.
And if you actually take, go back 2 or 3 years and pick out one of the magazines and read a report and see if you can figure out what actually happened, if you've forgotten what happened on the telly. Because often you'll be getting these analysis and insights of this and that, but it doesn't tell you the actual story of the race, because they've forgotten that bit. You know, so we believe that the old style way of doing it, as Autosport used to do, which is basically, you know, running copy, you know, the race started and the key points were this, this, and this, is actually a much better way of doing it, old-fashioned though it may be. You then, in a historical sense, in your computer, you can have the entire archive of Grand Prix Plus, and you can go look up any race you like. And it's like having, you know, paper magazines inside your computer for years to come, which is terrific. You know, it's going to be, hopefully, will be around for years and years and years, you know, without falling over because we work too hard. But, you know, I think there's a great future in it. But you know, educating people to buy things online is quite hard, because everything is free. And, you know, unless they want quality, they really have to pay for it nowadays, I'm afraid.
I mean, completely agree. And I think it's worth it. It doesn't sound like a huge amount of money. It sounds well worth the investment.
It's definitely a gap in the market, because I have the world's worst memory.
Yeah. Well, no, believe me, I probably have that. But that's why they invented the computer, you see, because it's these wonderful machines that have all the answers. And if you have a good search mechanism, there really is nothing like it. That's you know, that's something that's stand me in very good stead over the years, because I've got I started on the computers very, very early, in the mid 80s, when it was completely new, and so I have archives and stuff going all the way back there, which are all searchable very easily, which is, it's a magnificent thing to have, because I never sort of worry too much about trying to find it. You know, spend hours finding when did that happen, because I've got it all in the computer.
That's how you do it. That's the secret. He's given us
that
the secret.
Well, that's part of the secret of being able to, if you look at GrandPrix.com, if you look at the analysis of the stories, that happens very quickly. It's simply because I have a good search mechanism. I have a memory that will suddenly throw up something. Oh, didn't that happen, you know, whenever there's something in my head that says this happened at a certain point. For example, you know, this last week we've had the Brawns going around outrageously fast, and you're thinking, now is this real, or is this one of those sort of pre-season jobs, you know, and who's done that in the past? And you think of Prost Grand Prix, and you think of Arrows did it 1 year as well, you know, and you're wondering to yourself, are they really this quick? And it's good just to warn people, because you get, you know, when you get into the excitement of it all, if you're a fan, you look at the Brawns, they really are the whole second faster than everybody else. They're going to win the race by a million miles, you know. And you don't stop and think, well, hang on a minute, are they? Mm. And it's very difficult. Well, it's very difficult to analyze any kind of pre-season testing. You just don't know, unless people admit to it. You know, if you look, McLaren admitting the fact they're not very quick. And you could say that was fairly obvious, but for a long time you're thinking, man, they can't be that slow. You know, are they just sandbagging? Or like the Renault. The Renault is very interesting, because the Renault will suddenly appear up there in the hands of Fernando Alonso. But if you analyze what Piquet's done with the Renault, it's hopeless all the way along the way. So you have to ask the question, you know, Piquet's not great, but he's not that far off Alonso in the overall scheme of things. But when that car, if you look at the testing results, every time that car goes out, Alonso will be the one with the fast time that gets him into sort of, you know, top five or six and looks all right. And Piquet's always plodding around at the back somewhere. So it's very hard to analyze if that's them using Alonso to make it look better, or and the car has the pace of Piquet or a little bit faster than that. It's really hard time of year, and that's why Melbourne is so important. You know, we go and have a look and see, oh, no, this is what the real story is. But even then, actually, funnily enough, number of years have gone by where you go to Melbourne, you get a result, and you think, oh, that's rather strange. And then you go to the next race, it's completely different. We had that last year. If you remember Melbourne, we had all kinds of funny things. Like there was a Williams on the podium.
Yep.
There was Bourdais got up there into the heavy duty points scoring situation by a pure sort of safety car fluke, which people sort of forgot about later in the year. And, you know, there were some very odd results going on. which didn't then turn out to be true in the races that followed. So, you know, you can't always rely on the first race as being a good guide either.
When do you get home, by the way? If you're leaving, you said you're leaving next Wednesday. When do you get back to?
Well, I come back. I come back on the Monday after Malaysia, which would be whatever day it is. Probably the, can't remember the date, but it's basically Easter week. Yeah. And so the first thing I have to do is go straight to the Chinese embassy and start the process of getting a visa sorted out before they shut down for the holiday. And then hopefully that weekend, Easter weekend, where everything's shut down anyway, and then I'll be off to China probably on the Monday or Tuesday the following week. So although I'm on the ground at home for probably 7 days, at least two of those, probably three, will be spent trying to sort out the visas.
The first break you get is what, after which GP, then after we come back to Europe, and then
Bahrain. Then it's basically two sets of two consecutive weekends with one the Easter weekend between, so it's four races in 5 weekends, which is tough going. But this particular thing is tougher going because it's just intercontinental, which we haven't done anything quite like this. We've done four races in 5 weekends in Europe before, but we haven't done four races in 5 weekends, three continents and 50,000 flying miles before. So, but it's all part of the, you know, it's all part of the fun. Yeah. And when it gets really good is when at the end of the season you do the same thing, but you just throw one in the time zones completely the other way. You know, so you go to Brazil. So you go to, I can't even remember what it is, but it's like Singapore, Japan, back to Brazil, and then back to Abu Dhabi, all in the space of a few weeks. Which means that probably you'll get a sleep pattern back about Christmas time.
Thank the Lord for the off-season.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't really help much, the off-season, because there's always things to do. But, you know, I suppose there's a bit of downtime. But when Bernie comes up with the calendar, he doesn't think of it as something he's going to be doing all of them, because he doesn't do all of them. Therefore, he doesn't worry about, you know, whether or not it's actually killing people or not. It's just part of the fun, you know. I don't know. In a way, it's quite exciting. I mean, I think that Formula One keeps you young. I'm 47 years old, but I don't feel it at all. I feel I'm about sort of, you know, 21 really. And gallivanting around the world is quite fun. But you know, sometimes when you come down and sort of go into the real world and you see people of the same age, you think, oh my god, no, that can't be right. No, I'm a child. Let me go away and play again. You know. So, you know, it's a funny old world, but it's a kind of strange mobile village that flies around, but it's always a lot of fun.
Joe, we've taken up way too much of your time. We'd like to thank you for coming on the show, because we really appreciate you giving your time and your insight just before you head off. We're going to let you go now, but hopefully you'll come back and you'll join us again at some point this year. We'll continue to read your website, to read your blog. We're going to buy GP Plus right now, aren't we, Christine?
We are.
And we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to doing it again.